Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast titled, GAN for Military and Electronic Warfare Systems. My name is John McHale, Group Editorial Director with Military Embedded Systems and moderator for today's event. Our speakers today are Mark Faulkner, AMS-RFM Chief Technologist of Mercury Systems, and Charles Dewey, co-founder and CEO of Evans Capacitor Company. Mark is a Chief Technologist of Mercury AMS, a business unit focused on RF subsystem development and manufacturing for the defense industry. He has led the development of microwave and millimeter wave hardware for Hewlett-Packard, Bookham New Focus, and Endwave Corporation. Mark earned a BSEE from the University of California, Davis, with an emphasis on electromagnetic theory and semiconductor device physics, plus graduate-level coursework in Fourier analysis at Stanford, nonlinear circuit design at Santa Clara University, and program management and strategy development at MIT. In addition, he holds two business management certificates from Santa Clara University, June 2006, and UC Irvine, June 2009. He's been awarded 9 patents and has authored 5 technical articles. Our second speaker, Charles Dewey, is co-founder and CEO of Evans Capacitor Company. Since 1996, Evans Capacitor has been a leader in development and production of specialty capacitors for aerospace, defense, and other demanding applications. Mr. Dewey directs the business along with co-founder Dale Evans, the inventor of the Evans Capacitor technology. Mr. Dewey has an extensive background in manufacturing, marketing, and finance with several businesses, small and large, prior to founding Evans. He has a bachelor's degree in manufacturing engineering and MBA in finance. Today's event is sponsored by Mercury Systems, Evans Capacitor Company, and National Instruments. Now for some housekeeping announcements. This and all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded and used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. The eCast will consume about 40 to 45 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer session. Now to point out some important buttons on your screen. Please take note of the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you'll be able to view the slides in full screen mode. You can use the Download Slide button to view the slides as a PDF to see them larger. The next important button is the Forward to a Friend button, which enables you to email a friend to register for this event. The third button on your console window allows you to enter questions in real time. We'll do our best to address those questions during the closing Q&A session. If you have a question intended for a specific speaker, please note so at the beginning of your question. Otherwise, I'll hand out the questions equally to all our speakers. If you have a question pertaining to the eCast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the eCast. Please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the eCast with more information. Today's eCast will be archived online and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. And now, please turn over to our first speaker, Mark Faulkner. Mark?
Thank you, John. At a very high level, GAN power amplifier design challenges can be categorized within roughly a half a dozen disciplines. I'll briefly introduce these and their associated challenges before narrowing the scope of this webcast down to specific GAN power amplifier analog circuit techniques. That big PA in the picture is about the size of a shoebox. It's a 4-kilowatt GAN power amplifier used in secondary surveillance radar. And some of the examples in today's slides draw on the design of that PA. Within analog circuitry, you can condition the bias, protect the GAN, trigger alarms, shape pulses, and provide built-in tests. The goal of RF matching is to get the highest performance out of the transistor. You might be aiming for highest efficiency, raw sat power, or linearity. You can also band limit your response with the matching and of course, ensure stability. EM theory and modeling tools are used to simulate the passives, your combiners, for instance, your filters. It can also predict arcing. I have actually exceeded the 3 times 10 to the 6 volts per meter inside my amplifier, creating arcing. And if you'll note that picture in the upper right-hand side, that's the electric field intensity of a 10-way combiner. Thermal management is a topic all in itself. Suffice to say, it's quite sophisticated in these types of products. Transient thermal analysis, using pulses in a material that has a non-linear thermal resistance as a function of time is quite challenging. The mechanical design challenges include cavity isolation, grounding, connectors and traces that carry high currents. And if you notice the picture in the upper left-hand side, that's an energy band diagram. It's depicting an intermediate energy level called a trap. These are caused by tiny defects in either the GaN material growth or the wafer fab. What happens is a hole will permanently recombine with an electron, effectively compensating both those carriers, and you lose that charge. It can no longer travel through the channel. So what you'll see is a drop in current after the first few hours. This is one of the reasons we want to burn in the gallium nitride or RF power blast it to compensate all those traps and get that current to settle out. I'm not going to belabor assembly processes or test strategies other than to ensure that you can prevent voiding underneath the die. Make sure you have a good die attached there. Use sonoscan measurements to image those. And honestly, the real needle movers when it comes to cost, I'm going to have to say, are in the mechanical design category and the assembly processes and test strategies. Now we're going to get on to the GaN power amplifier analog circuit design techniques. We're going to cover the following four analog circuit design topics: regulation, sequencing the bias, detection and alarms, and pulse control. Notice the top right picture. That's a blown GaN FET. It could have been from voiding, improper bias sequencing. Maybe the technician actually shorted out the bias when he was in there tuning. And then the bottom right-hand picture shows a power amplifier RF spectrum output. Notice the low-frequency spurs. Those are caused sometimes by the switching regulator, or if you have logic devices in your unit, they could be clock frequencies. And you'll also notice you can see the harmonics of the fundamental there also. So starting with regulation, we have to convert the filter. We have to convert filter and sometimes invert the power amplifier supply voltage to usable clean voltages. The cleanest regulator is the linear. You end up throwing away a couple of volts of overhead. Low dropout regulators or LDOs, you only lose a quarter to a half a volt. But then now you've introduced spurs onto the bias. DC to DC switching converters are efficient, and they can also step voltages up in addition to inverting them. You can put in a positive voltage and get a negative voltage or even a higher voltage out of the DC to DC switching converter. These switchers and LDOs introduce spurs, however, roughly in the 20 kilohertz to 2 megahertz range. So you want to employ low-frequency filtering on the bias lines. These are traditionally shunt capacitors and maybe some series Ls to clean up those spurs such that they don't get on the RF and modulate it. The plot on the upper right is the open loop gain of a low dropout regulator, and it shows three poles. This is important because these regulators can be unstable if the ESR, or equivalent series resistance, of the output capacitance is not carefully chosen. And it can't be too big, and it can't be too small. Your LDO data sheet will give you a table. It's a log-log table. It shows you, for a given capacitance, what you want to choose your ESR to be. The block diagram at the bottom is an example of a regulation tree in a power amplifier. That 52 volts on the supply actually forks off right to the gallium nitride drains. But then it also goes into this dual switcher, which generates a variety of voltages using different regulators. The 11 volts I use, let's say, for pre-driver mimics, 10 volts might be the high-speed analog switch for gate control. Minus 10 volts will pinch off the gates in between the pulses. And that linear 3 volts I use on an RS422 differential transmitter, and that will output alarms and temp sensing to the rest of the system. To measure the effect of bias, ripple, and spurs on a GaN power amplifier, you want to impress a voltage ripple on the input of the bias and then measure the RF spectrum. The scope trace shows a 5 megahertz half-volt peak-to-peak ripple. I put that on the 52-volt bias line, and then I look at the RF spectrum on the plot on the right. Now, it's difficult to tell, but there are two traces on this plot, one with the ripple on the bias and one without. And as you can tell, they're laying on top of each other, which means we've done a pretty good job of cleaning up the supply voltage ripples and spurs. Now, sequencing is important. The gallium nitride FETs require the negative voltage to be applied before the drain voltage is turned on or off. This IC in the example is a maximum part. It will invert a positive 5 volts to minus 5 volts for your GaN gates. And it also sequences the drains, ensuring that the PA is not powered up until the negative bias is present. There are other ways to do this with bipolar transistors in various configurations. This is a simple chip that I've employed before. That POK pin stays high until the negative voltage reaches 92.5% of its regulated output. Then it goes low, which turns on the P-channel MOSFET. Note that the pull-up resistor on the MOSFET, that will hold the MOSFET off until POK goes low. That's typically in the 50K to 100K ohm range. A couple notes of caution, though, here on sequencing. GaN hemp gates can draw significant gate current on the order of a milliamp per millimeter of gate periphery. This maximum chip will only source 4 milliamps. That'll work safely on a device in the 5-watt range or roughly 2 millimeters of gate periphery. But if you want to drive a 90-watt GaN transistor, you're going to have to run that V out from the maximum pin into a pass transistor. A 90-watt GaN transistor can draw 36 milliamps of gate current. And these GaN hemp gates are really Schottky diodes. And that gate current will also vary as a function of drive level. At low RF drive, the gate current is small and negative. But as you drive the device into saturation, the gate current switches polarity and can increase to tens of milliamps. And the reason this is important is when the gate current changes, you get a corresponding voltage drop across the gate resistor. So keep your gate resistor as small as possible. On a 2-millimeter gate periphery GaN device, 200 ohms is appropriate. And on a 36-millimeter gate periphery GaN device, it's closer to 10 ohms. Now, if it's sequenced properly, this trace is what you should see. The purple trace is the 52-volt supply, and as soon as it starts to turn on, you'll notice the red negative gate voltage rapidly switches to minus 10 volts. And looking at that purple trace, you can see the slow ramp up of the 52 volts. This will ensure that the device stays pinched off while the 52 volts is turning on. And then conversely, when you're powering down, you want to make sure you keep that negative voltage on the gate until the positive supply is completely off. So here on this scope trace, we see the green 52 volts ramping down, and the purple minus 10 volts is present on the gates well after the 52 volts has dropped to zero. These are measurements you want to make on your circuit to ensure that you're protecting your GaN parts. Discrete GaN FETs, even if you purchase them by the wafer, they're very expensive. And you want to protect these using analog circuitry techniques. So there's a whole host of detections and alarms and shutdowns you can integrate into your power amplifier to protect the GaN. With an output forward detector, you can detect loss of output power. And in a critical system application, this might queue up the switch over to a redundant PA. With an output reverse power detector, you can shut down the PA when high viswire is detected on the output. This might happen in test in your factory or when the PA is being installed out in the field. If you don't have the output connected properly, that open circuit could reflect back into the drains of the gallium nitride and damage your devices. With an input forward detector on your power amplifier, you can protect the PA drivers from high input power. You can also protect the GaN output stages from excessive duty cycles or excessive pulse lengths. One way to do this is have a logic device in your power amplifier like a CPLD, and using that input forward power detector, you sample every 20 nanoseconds to see if you have RF present. And then you count those in buckets, and that'll exceed a certain number if your duty cycle is too long or your pulse lengths are too long and shut the PA down. The plot just shows a way to measure that, where you just increase the pulse repetition frequency until the threshold is met and it shuts down the PA. Now, pulse control is a particularly important topic. Radars require operation in pulsed mode, and this is an example of a pulsar circuit. A TTL input into the driver turns on the P-channel MOSFET to power up the gallium nitride drains with some help from the C1 discharging. Now, C1 discharge capacitor is in a special class of energy storage capacitors that my webcast partner, Charlie Dewey, will expand on. A couple of notes about this circuit. To maintain high switching speeds, you want to keep your drain line capacitance very low. Typically, you load these lines up with capacitors to prevent oscillations. And also, keep the connecting line between the circuit and the drains short, because series inductance here will harm you in two ways. First, it can form a resonant circuit in conjunction with the circuit capacitance. This degrades the RF pulse with voltage ripple if that resonant circuit is oscillating. Secondly, when the current is turned off, this inductance will have a collapsing magnetic field, which will induce a voltage spike that, if unchecked, could damage the RF device. So in some cases, we'll put a diode between the drain and ground to protect the RF device. Now, you can't always, when you have a distributed power amplifier combiner, you can't always get a single pulsar to drive all of the devices. So you can distribute these pulsars to each of the output stages. And if you do that, make sure that your TTL lines are the same length and they branch from a common point. And that'll keep everything synced up correctly. So in conclusion, you know, there's a lot of things you can do with analog design techniques to enhance the performance and protect your semiconductors. I encourage you to use time domain simulators like SPICE to model your design. Get a prototype up and running as quick as possible. Make your mistakes. And if you can, put logic devices in your power amplifier. This, like I mentioned, the CPLD that can count pulses and shut the PA down if you have excessive duty cycle. And as a good designer, make sure that affordability and manufacturability are considered in every design trade-off. You can learn more about our GaN amplifier technology at the Mercury website. And if you have any questions, please contact Greg Donahue. His email is at the bottom of this last slide. Back to you, John.
Thank you very much. Excellent presentation. And I'd also like to remind the audience, we see some questions coming in during Mark's presentation. We will get to those after Charles is finished. So if you have questions, please keep them coming in and keep these guys busy when they're done talking. That'll be great. And now I'll turn it over to Charles. Thank you.
Thank you, John. I'm Charlie Dewey from Evans. First of all, I'm not an electrical engineer, and at Evans we don't make or design amplifiers, so I don't know a lot about how GaN works or why or much about designing amplifiers. So thanks to Mark Faulkner for knowing all about that and providing that information, and he'll be answering all of those questions. At Evans, we do know a bit about energy storage. We develop and manufacture capacitors for a variety of very special applications, including phased array radar. In fact, more than 20 years ago, one of the first applications that approached us was for airborne surveillance radar. In the past few years, especially with GaN technology enabling significant high power, there's been a tremendous push into higher power amplifiers for transmit-receive modules. That development has led to a surge in interest in energy storage requirements and devices, and so we've been asked to provide more and more power with every new design. Defense and airborne systems are the most critical applications, so that's what we'll focus on today. Okay, little introduction to begin with. The problem that we're going to talk about is why we need energy storage capacitors. We'll do a little analysis and calculation of how much energy we need to store and how do we get it. Solutions are what capacitor can provide the energy storage that we need, and what are the other requirements and selection criteria for energy storage capacitors. And then in conclusion, what we learned and what we can do about it. So, what do we mean by power to the pulse? Well, I figured the first thing I needed to know was a little bit more about transmit-receive modules, so I bought a textbook. Transmit-receive modules for radar and communication systems, and I found this brief statement about energy storage capacitors in TR modules. Our textbook tells us that the pulsed output must have enough power supplied to maintain the current throughout the pulse with a minimum of voltage droop. So that's what we mean by power to the pulse. With a very low power pulse and with a big enough power supply, we could cover the pulse by simply switching the power supply to our TR module and letting the output of the supply drive the pulse. This isn't very efficient as our supply needs to be able to provide the peak power, which is far higher than the average power. And as we increase the power required in the pulse, the less practical this becomes. So we store energy, as Mark said, from the supply in capacitors and discharge the capacitors into the module for the pulse. This introduces us to why we need energy storage for our TR module. Okay, our textbook provided an example so we can understand a bit about the pulse and what defines droop. Pulse droop is a measure of the decrease in output power from the beginning to the end of the pulse. The example in my book was a cooled gallium nitride-based 20-watt amplifier with 43.56 dBm pulse of 3.5 microseconds. But at 20-watt peak, we can understand the concept, but it doesn't help us much for a very high-power design. To make a very high-power phased array would require a large number of duplicate TR modules. A powerful phased array might be 20 kilowatts. So in this model, we would need 1,000 20-watt TR modules in the array. GaN can enable very much higher power TR modules. So instead of 1,000 TR modules at 20 watts, why not 20 TR modules at 1,000 watts? These TR modules need very high power pulses to transmit and must maintain that power throughout the pulse. As our textbook says, we need to maintain the pulse while minimizing voltage droop. Mark, in the previous discussion, described a 4-kilowatt amplifier. That's 200 times the power of the example in the book. With 200 times the power requirement, it's obvious that the energy storage capacitor requirement is going to be very different. It all adds up to needing a lot of DC power storage. So let's find out how we get it and where we can get it. But before we go too far, it's not just energy storage or capacitance that we need. GaN can enable very compact designs for TR modules. So new phased arrays, especially airborne, are much more compact, yet more powerful than the previous technology allowed. So there are a lot of other challenges that we have to tackle with these high-power TR modules. As we look at technologies and devices to provide our DC energy storage, we'll also evaluate them against these challenges of highest power, compact design, and low ESR. We need new technology, high power energy storage to maximize performance, efficiency, and volumetric utilization. Okay, the first challenge, how do we provide all that power? To get the higher power pulse, we need a combination of higher voltage, higher current, wider pulse width, aggressive duty cycles. This makes for design challenges. As we increase currents in lower voltage, we get to bigger and bigger conductors, and that can be a problem. So we want to store the voltage at a higher, we want to store the power at a higher voltage. So operating at a higher voltage has a great advantage. Even in gas systems, powering at a higher voltage and then stepping down very close to the gas amplifier can help, as a lot more power can be stored. But we do bring in down-convert challenges and losses in stepping down the voltage. So actually keeping the higher voltage level for the GaN amplifier can provide the most benefit. In either case, high power needs to be stored to drive the pulse, and storing it at higher voltage provides the biggest power advantage. So for the highest power, we want to have the highest possible voltage, be able to increase the pulse width, and still maintain a healthy current. So what energy storage is needed to supply the power level? We can approximate how much capacitance is required to provide the energy storage by this equation. C equals I times delta T divided by delta V. It's pretty simple. The higher the current, the longer the pulse, the more capacitance you need to store for any given allowable voltage group. Now, of course, our power supply provides some of this power continuously. But if we look at it based on sizing the energy storage capacitor to provide the entire pulse, we are assured of designing a module that can provide more power than is required. Certainly a nice place to start. So we'll look at a couple of examples and compute the energy storage capacitance that we need. The first scenario is a lower voltage, lower power transmit pulse. And the second is a high power 1 kilowatt S-band transmit pulse. We can see here in our equation that the duty cycle doesn't matter in calculating the capacitance requirement, but it obviously matters for the charge and discharge times of the capacitor and the ripple currents. We certainly know that ripple currents and the heat generated matter greatly for the life and health of all your components and for how we keep them cool. So in our first scenario, we have a lower voltage TR with a 40-watt peak. This could be either a GaN or a gas module. It's a 10 microsecond pulse at 8 volts, but with a pretty high current of 5 amps. We'll limit the voltage group to 5% or 0.4 volts. We calculate the capacitance required to be 125 microfarads. Now, we would not spec the capacitor at 8 volts and 125 microfarads as we want to ensure long life and reliability. So we pick a higher voltage, higher cap device to provide margin and D-rate. Even so, with margin and D-rate, we come up with a capacitor of about 220 to 250 microfarads at 16 volts. We can get that rating with a surface mount tantalum cap. And traditionally, and in many, many phased arrays designed and built today, this is exactly how it's done. Now, we'll go to scenario two, which is a much higher power S-band, 1 kilowatt peak power. To provide the 1 kilowatt, the transmit pulse is higher voltage, say 50 volts, higher current, 20 amps, and a much longer pulse than in the previous example, 100 microseconds versus 10 microseconds. So it's easy to see that we need a lot more capacitance in order to hold up or maintain that voltage throughout the long pulse, especially since I really limit the voltage group to 2% or only 1 volt. We calculate that we would need 2,000 microfarads at 50 volts to keep the voltage group to 1 volt. Again, we would want to increase the voltage rating of the capacitor for D-rate and increase the base capacitance just to make sure we have enough. So something approaching 4,000 microfarads and 80 or 100 volts is what we need. Doubling the capacitance and voltage rating is very conservative, But it's better to start there and work to be more aggressive than start out with a dragster and fail in your first test. So calculating the capacitance is the easy part. Now we need to find capacitors that will do the job. In the traditionally designed lower power units, we use surface mount capacitors. Now, even though we call this a low power transmit, in a phased array radar with lots of these units, it can become very powerful, as the overall power requirement of the whole array can be very large. As we said previously, to build up very high power phased array, we would require hundreds or thousands of these TR modules. The problem is that we soon get into severe space and weight limitations as we add more and more. We also have issues with high ripple currents causing our surface mount caps to ignite if not fused, and the reliability questions associated with having thousands of caps per array. So in the new very high power TR modules, it's easy to see why the surface mount design capacitors just won't work, even at the lower voltage. Plus, to get to the higher power, we already determined that we need to go to higher voltage. The surface mount caps won't even go to the voltage ratings that we need. So the new TR modules are different. As mentioned, we now have single TR modules greater than 1 kilowatt. As Mercury showed, amplifiers of 4 kilowatts. We have a customer with a 20 kilowatt peak power assembly, and over 75% of that requirement must be provided by the energy storage capacitors. So we need higher voltage, higher capacitance capacitors. We see that the surface mount capacitors will not work, so we need to look at something else. So we'll look at aluminum and tantalum wet. It's easy to find capacitors that will provide the energy storage, but should we use them? That depends on the qualification requirements of our system. Is it airborne, defense, space, all of the above? The standard grade aluminum electrolytic on the left may be fine for testing your circuit, but does it have the reliability and life performance characteristics necessary for these kind of systems? The solution on the right, multiple tantalum wet capacitors in parallel, gives us the capacitance and voltage rating we need in a hermetic solution. And we've seen current designs of TR modules with 1, 2, 3, even 10 tantalum wets in parallel. But continuing to add more and more in parallel gets very heavy and bulky in our new small form factor TR modules. And in all of these high-value systems, reducing weight and volume is critical. That's our second challenge, volume and weight limitations. So we need to look for something a little better. Newer technology devices provide needed advantages in energy density, so the volume and weight required to get the energy storage is greatly reduced. The newer technology aluminum electrolytics, and we show one here with 3,300 microfarads at 100 volts, would probably do the job. And although they are energy dense compared with the multiple tantalum wets we looked at previously, they can still be quite bulky and heavy in the new design modules. The tantalum wet hybrid design, shown here with 4,400 microfarads at 100 volts, offers high reliability and is the most energy dense. In the 50-volt operating range, they can be a quarter the volume and only half the weight of the aluminum capacitors. The more capacitance you need, the greater this advantage can become, because this is all part of the size, weight, and footprint of your module. Our third challenge is high currents and ripple. We want our current capability to be high, considerably above our pulse current. The higher currents we need may be right at the spec limits of the aluminum device, which presents a reliability concern. The tantalum wet hybrid type is not current limited. We also need to look at the ESR and response time of the capacitors. We want our rise time to be very fast, the current capability to be high, and the ESR to be low. Ripple currents can get very large, so component temperature rise and the ability to remove that heat also become very important factors. To recap, our energy storage solution must have higher operating voltage, up to 50 volts and maybe up to 100 volt rating. high bulk capacitance. We saw up to 4,000, and in many systems today, much, much more capacitance than that. Fast rise time and unlimited cycle life. For obvious reasons, in phased array radar, you get to billions of cycles very quickly. Our high power pulse has other challenges: high ripple currents and voltage overshoots. So our energy storage capacitor must also have low ESR, good heat transfer characteristics, and low inductance. In defense and airborne systems, for very high power phased array radar TR modules, our energy storage must provide the required power and, in the minimum weight and volume allowed, perform over temperature range, have excellent heat transfer, and have very high reliability. Remember, it does us little good to design a high-power, super-efficient, small-footprint TR module if we need big old bulky capacitors hanging on the outside. This is especially true in defense, base, and airborne systems where size and weight are paramount to the solution. On airborne systems, the size and weight of the individual components adds to the size and weight of the overall system, which can greatly increase the cost. Also, bigger components may need to be moved farther away, resulting in longer conductor paths. And we must perform in some circumstances under extreme temperature and environmental conditions. We might be required to turn on at minus 40 C and provide the same pulse power. Also, our high-power TR module may generate a great deal of heat, so our energy storage capacitor must be easily cooled. And in airborne systems, cooling is a great concern. And the capacitors must be very reliable. So, in conclusion, GaN, especially on silicon carbide and diamond, can enable high-power TR modules in defense and airborne systems that require new technology, high-power energy storage to maximize performance, efficiency, and volumetric utilization. We showed that it's easy to calculate the DC energy storage requirements for a given transmit pulse requirement. We investigated different capacitor technologies that are available to provide the DC energy storage. And finally, we investigated other criteria that are required of our energy storage capacitors in the new high-power systems. Every system is different, and the importance of these performance criteria determines the appropriate selection of technology and capacitor device. For the highest power and high reliability, volume and weight critical applications, the tantalum wet hybrid design provides the designer with the greatest benefits. Thank you for your attention. My email address is here on this last slide, along with additional information about TDD series capacitors, which are the most energy dense and efficient we offer. They're used in a wide variety of very high power applications, including phased array radars. Thank you. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, gentlemen. Excellent presentation. And now we're going to start our Q&A with some great questions that came in during the presentation. I encourage you in the next 15 to 20 minutes to shoot them in and keep these guys on their toes. You got them at your beck and call. So the first question I have here is for Charlie. Charlie, what would the material of the capacitor, e.g. tantalum, be critical to the successful life of the capacitor?
Tantalum capacitors tend to have extremely long life. They also do not require reforming like aluminum capacitors do. They operate extremely well in pulse applications. So tantalum has been used for a long time. The difference now, the surface mount tantalums tended to have problems with high ripple current and failing shorted. The tantalum wet capacitors used a lot now, and the way our hybrid capacitors are designed do not fail short, and they tend to keep their performance criteria over a very long life.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Next question is for Mark. Mark, why does the dual switcher use 52 volts as input while the output swings between plus minus 10 volts?
Okay, so I'll go back to that slide. The question is, why am I using 52 into that switcher? It turns out that this is part of a radar system, and the system provides 52 volts to my power amplifier. And it's actually being regulated upstream from something like 480 volts. So this is really just dependent on the specific application that it's being used in. But while I'm on the topic, that upstream power supply, that voltage regulator, operates in a difficult environment because it's required to provide a constant voltage even while the load is pulsed. So if you don't heed Charlie Dewey's guidance and equations and derating criteria well, what will happen is under some combination of pulse length and duty cycle, the voltage regulator may partially lose regulation. Then the output voltage fluctuates, typically only slightly, and it's at a rate that's determined by the response time of the regulator. And what you'll see is a train of equal amplitude RF input pulses translated by the amplifier into pulses of slightly different amplitudes. And this causes very puzzling effects in the operation of the system. So if you detect this problem, go back to Charlie's equations and increase the capacity of your charge storage capacitor.
Okay. Thank you. And nice throwback to Charlie. Next question for the audience, Mark, is once again for you. How do you clean up the low-frequency spurs without adding to FET GaN drain capacitance?
Okay, that's insightful because I mentioned you don't want to load down that drain line with capacitance in order to maintain high switching speeds. So really, in order to clean up those low frequency noise on that line and prevent bias oscillations, you have to rely on your charge capacitor, C1 in the slide that's being shown.
Okay. Next question. Let's see. Hold on a second. Next question. For Charlie, I'm going to get Charlie back in here. What are the selection criteria for capacitor technology style in these systems? I think they're meaning military.
Yeah. In the very high reliability systems, and a lot of what we do in defense phased arrays and airborne phased arrays, the number one criteria is probably reliability, life of the system. So in designing these systems, first of all, you're designing for a generation ahead. You know, looking for a leap forward in technology, which is going to be produced over a long period of time and be operated for a long period of time. So, the challenges are number one, it has to be very reliable, and number two, there are always size, weight, and power criteria. Size and weight are usually the biggest issues because as all the customers want the highest possible power, the trade-off is as you add more power, you take up more and more space and add more and more weight to your overall system. If it's on a truck or a boat or an airplane, you very soon start to run out of space. So size and weight are very important criteria, but of course you have to get the performance that you want first, and then move into the size and weight so that you can optimize the system for what you're looking for.
Okay. Thank you, Charlie. Next question from the audience, and they keep coming in, so keep them coming, guys. For Mark, on slide 5, you show a cross-section of a conical combiner. Have you successfully power combined using this technique?
Yes, let me pull that slide up. So I can describe one of our designs at X-band. The intention was to achieve 1 kilowatt, and at Mercury we have a crack engineer who has parameterized this model in CST, and he has actually incorporated some novel techniques to shrink it a bit and absorb some of the or reduce some of the tight tolerances that are normally required of this. If you look closely at that red ring in the very center, that's where the coaxial transformer comes close to the, there's a very small gap there, and the field is very high. And so, you know, one of our techniques was to employ some special materials to open that up. And the loss that we're measuring through this thing is slightly high. It's our goal was 0.2. We're measuring 0.27, but we have some mitigating techniques to try to bring that loss back down. So the short answer is yes, we have used this radial combiner.
Okay. Thank you. Next question is for Charlie. Some time ago, I've seen a tantalum capacitor exploded on the PC board. Would it be possible to mention some of manufacturers' suggested best practices around using the capacitors?
Yeah, the most common exploded device would probably be a tantalum chip capacitor. And, you know, in most of these systems now, the capacitors are fused. And the reason they're fused is that, you know, they tend to fail in a short failure mode, which then causes them to burn up and also makes a mess of your board. In wet capacitors, there are a couple of things that would cause that. Number one is a reverse voltage. Have to be extremely careful that you don't have any reverse voltage. Any kind of a over voltage situation. And the third condition is one that you can definitely get to by, you know, overly stressing in your design, is by overheating the capacitor. And we've done this in testing many times where you increase the pulse and increase the duty cycle to the point where the ripple current is so high that you can no longer remove the heat from the capacitor, and the components heat up and you overheat the capacitor, and it will swell up and eventually it will go. So the best practices are to in all situations, fusing may be used. In our situations, there, you know, we have to make absolutely sure you don't have any reverse voltage, and also that you are not allowing the capacitor to heat up so much that you exceed the operating temperature of the capacitor.
Okay. Thank you, Charlie. Next question. This one's for Charlie, too. In a GaN-based airborne radar system, how many similar capacitors may be required? Can this system be used on existing platforms without much change in platform supplier power supply rating?
In certain circumstances, yes. If you had a TR module with a whole bunch of gang together tantalum wets, you may be able to replace a whole gang of tantalum wets with a single unit. There are airborne phased arrays with, you know, hundreds and hundreds of very large capacitors in them, and there are arrays, flat panel arrays. I think the B-1 bomber had 6,000 TR modules on it. So it depends on the style of what the system looks like today as to whether some of those capacitors could be replaced. But in airborne radars, we you know, we go all the way up to hundreds of units in, you know, in a very large surveillance array.
Okay. Thank you, Charlie. Next question, this one is from Mark. Would GAN type of components be manufactured in the U.S. or not? Sounds like an export regs kind of question.
Yeah. So you can obtain GAN both from stateside and international sources. A couple examples, in Taiwan, Wind Semiconductor provides gallium nitride. Stateside, you can go to either Corvo, Cree, and there are others. Some of the primes themselves have their own gallium nitride processes that they open up to designers, BAE and Northrop as examples. So you can obtain the gallium nitride from a variety of locations.
And essentially, Mark, I'd like to follow up on that. Are they, for the most part, your GAN components are dual use. They're presented, not designed just for military components, so that kind of removes some of the international traffic and arms regulations headaches, I would think.
And I'll say I don't want to speak for lawyers either, but that's only to a certain point. There are some combinations, especially in millimeter wave, and GAN, as you know, can go all the way up to W-band, but combinations of power and frequency can be subject to regulations in international arms and trafficking.
ITAR.
ITAR.
All right. Thank you, sir. Next question from the audience. This one's for Mark. What was the rationale of using TTL circuitry instead of other logic family components to drive driver stage in slide number 11?
You can use any number of logic devices, different components. TTL in this case was chosen because that's what the radar system was providing to the GAN amplifier. So it was really a higher level source control drawing from the radar manufacturer, but really there's no reason that you could you don't have to use TTL. You can use other logic families for driving the drivers on that MOSFET.
Okay. Next question. What are some of the most common misunderstandings or misconceptions about using GAN technology here from your military designers? I've heard a lot from folks when I go to International Microwave Symposium or Association of Old Crows that there's still a learning curve with the user base on GAN. Do you hear that too? What are some of the stories? Do you have any stories along those or case studies?
Well, yeah, I'll start with that. You know, early on, gallium nitride had reliability concerns. The fabs started seeing drops in current that would never level out. They'd run these things for 1,000 hours, and it was still dropping in current. So they incorporated some semiconductor fab techniques, something called an iron buffer and some other things to level it out. That's all behind us. Gallium nitride is quite reliable these days. But there is a long history of folks that are, they have a long memory of these things being unreliable. That is not the case any longer. Gallium nitride can be more expensive. It kind of depends on the frequency range. I'd say L-band, S-band, you still might want to consider LDMOS. Just when you think LDMOS is in your rearview mirror, it comes up with another development and maintains a healthy competition with GAN. Above a few gigahertz, so I prefer gallium nitride. I think the price point's a little bit better. You can design your own GAN devices and have them fabbed by the wafer for cost advantages. It's got a really its advantages are so compelling though versus those challenges. I mean, you can actually run these into much higher channel temps if you have to, 200, 250 degrees C. The power densities are higher, the impedances are lower, so they're easier to match broadband. So there's really some significant advantages. The CapEx and the OpEx are lower for the users of these power amplifiers in that you might not necessarily need air or liquid cooling to cool these things down on the OpEx side. On the CapEx side, the reliability is so rugged that you end up not having to replace these for decades. So along with the challenges, there's some really compelling advantages to using gallium nitride.
And the price will come down just like solid state eventually did.
You'd expect that, John. Yep, you'd expect that.
Okay. Anything you'd like to add on that, Charlie, or we'll just go to the next question? Your call.
No, just go to the next one.
Okay. This one, it's not assigned to anyone. Is there ever an increase in dielectric breakdown given the increased capabilities of GaN technology? Anybody want to take that one?
I don't know whether that's a question of dielectric breakdown of the capacitors, or that has something else to do with GaN that I don't know. Capacitor-wise, I would say that dielectric breakdown, if it's solid capacitors and dielectric breakdown happens due to very high ripple currents, then it's probably a yes. Once again, you have to be very careful that you're not exceeding the limitations of your cap, because the GaN does have greater capabilities, and you could be going to higher currents and higher voltages. So if that's the question, that would be the answer I'd have. I don't know whether Mark has anything else on that.
Well, I just add, Charlie, first of all, I agree with you, but all the materials used in these power amplifiers, especially around the output, you have to take into account the dielectric breakdown of the material. In the 4 kilowatt PA, our RMS voltage is on the order of close to 500 volts, and peak to peak, it's closer to 1,261 volts. And in one case, I had a circulator body that was too close to the trace, and that's where arcing occurred. So you want to round the sharp corners of your traces and potentially use varnish, an additional dielectric layer, to prevent this arcing and breakdown in dielectric strength.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Next question. I'll go with Charlie. How do you manage obsolescence lifecycle challenges of your GaN components? A huge problem with radar systems today, and doubly so with all the swap challenges every time you upgrade.
Right. Well, I don't have any GaN components, but in the capacitor world, what we basically have is extremely long life cycles, and we don't have obsolescence issues. If we're designing a system today for a customer, and they say this system must operate into the 2040s or the 2050s, we understand that, number one, we're attempting to design capacitors that will, that will live, and perform through that life, but also be able to continue to provide and replace parts into that life with the same heritage that they designed in the beginning.
Okay. Last question. We're getting close to our time limit. This will be the last question. I'm going to give this to Charlie. Why does low ESR and heat transfer matter so much for these high power systems?
Well, let me talk about airborne systems, because that's where you run into it the very most. We have high power airborne systems, and things get very hot. And in airborne systems, in order to cool them, you may have a pretty large liquid cooling system. And all of that cooling system is parasitic. It does no good other than to cool. And so in airborne systems where you're looking at space and weight limitations, having a big cooling system circulate fluid and having to cool all of the components is a big cost factor and space factor. So it's very important that your components are going to heat up, but if you have a much lower ESR, you would get less heat generated from the same ripple. And, of course, being able to conduct away the heat in an efficient manner is always very helpful because that helps your cooling system as well.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Mark. That brings us right up to our time limit for today. Sorry we cannot get to all of your questions. Someone may get back to you after the ECAS with more information. I'd like to thank Mark Faulkner and Charlie Dewey for speaking today, and Mercury Systems, Evans Capacitor Company, and National Instruments for sponsoring the event. Please remember that this and all Open Systems Media ECAST are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the expressed written consent of Open Systems Media. This ECAST will be archived online today and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. Thank you all for attending, and I look forward to seeing you on future Open Systems Media ECAST. Goodbye.